This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And coming up in the second half of today's show, Matt Olien reviews the new Godzilla vs. Kong film. And we have our weekly news discussion with Dave Thompson. But we are going to start today with mindful self-compassion and the science behind being kind to yourself. We're visiting with licensed professional clinical counselor and certified clinical mental health counselor, Melissa Dahl, who is giving that presentation this coming Tuesday from 3:30 to 5 p.m. through the Fargo-Moorhead Chamber. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on this morning. I appreciate that.
What does self-compassion mean to you as a counselor?
Well, self-compassion is really the act of being kind to yourself or treating yourself the same way that you would treat a good friend who is struggling or going through a hard time.
Why do you think it is that doesn't seem too hard to do to other people, but we're not always as good doing that to ourselves?
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really good question because actually self-compassion kind of gets a little bit of a kickback because the word itself, people don't really like that much because we kind of live in a culture where we don't spend a lot of time slowing down and like to do a lot of things for ourselves in gentle or kind ways. So when I started teaching the topic in our community about 6 years ago, I would ask people to raise their hands if they've heard of self-compassion, and maybe one or two people would raise their hand. And now when I ask that question, I would say probably over half of the people raise their hand. So the language of self-compassion is definitely growing in the community. But the reason that I, you know, come to understand that it's so hard is because we are much more critical on ourselves, and the research shows that, than we are on other people. We're much more willing to give other people grace than we are to ourselves. And so we have to actually learn to be kind to ourselves. It's a tool that we have to teach ourselves to use. And that's why I teach self-compassion, because it's a tool that we use and that we can actually begin to use in our daily lives. It's not something that comes natural for us.
Yeah, I saw on your website, themindfulhealing.org, there is a statistic on there that says 78% of people say that they are pretty good at putting other people's needs and wants in front of themselves, and only 2% of people say that they put themselves ahead of others. And, you know, you can talk about people's ability to judge their own behavior. But 78%, that actually sounds, though, like a pretty good thing, that the majority of this world is good at recognizing other people's needs. Why do we need to add some of that focus back to ourselves?
Well, yeah, you're making a good point. It is really good to be other-focused. It is good to recognize other people's needs and to notice when someone else is struggling and to be able to offer them kindness and compassion. The hard part is that when we are critical of ourselves or we neglect our own well-being, we also begin to experience burnout. We also begin to experience self-neglect. And then that leads to its own set of symptoms. So we have higher anxiety, we have higher depression, we have higher rates of mental health, we have higher rates of isolation. And so although we are able to offer other people support, we are becoming neglected ourselves. So yes, that number looks really good because I'm able to turn around and give you support, but then I also am neglecting myself. So I need to find out who is supporting me then, and how am I getting my needs met? If I'm able to give other people support, that's wonderful, but I need to make sure that I'm not receiving burnout or, you know, reaching depression or anxiety myself.
Sure.
And need to be able to be mindful of where I'm at in that as well.
That concept of you can't pour out of an empty cup.
Exactly.
When you talk about burnout. And then you talk about things like anxiety and depression. And obviously, those are big signs that we haven't been taking care of ourselves. What are some of the little signs? Like, if our body's whispering at us versus our body is shouting at us.
Yeah, that's a really good question. So just even low-level irritability, like I don't really want to listen anymore. I'm kind of shutting down in this moment.
Ooh.
I kind of feel on edge. I feel a little irritable. Maybe I feel kind of sleepy or tired. I just kind of feel overwhelmed at the end of my day, and that one little thing that's going to be added, I don't want to do that. I'm saying yes when I need to be saying no. To an extra thing. I am agreeing to something that doesn't actually sit right with who I am. It doesn't align with my core value. I'm not getting my basic needs met because I'm putting my kids' needs or other people's needs before my own. I'm running on guilt because I don't know how to express my feelings and wants. You know, all of those things can show up on a daily basis without crossing over into anxiety and depression, and have a lot to do with being critical of ourselves or how other people perceive us.
And would those maybe show up in the body in a certain way? Again, maybe not quite anxiety or depression, but something like, I don't know, biting your nails or, yeah, what would be some of those to watch for?
Yeah, like tightening of the shoulders. Even if you were to just take a moment right now, like in this radio show right now, and just notice your shoulders tightening up by your neck, or if you were to just drop your shoulders away from your ears, you just notice that right now you can hold that space between your shoulders and your ears. If you just let that drop, you'll notice that we naturally tighten our shoulders blades to our ears. We hold tension there most of the day. So even just taking a few moments throughout the day and dropping our shoulder blades down, that's an area that we hold tension in our body. So holding tension throughout the body is a sign of, releasing cortisol, but grinding our teeth, biting the inside of our lips, biting the inside of our cheeks, biting our lips, our nails, the leg shaking quickly. Yeah, all those are signs of the body being a little bit under stress or feeling stress.
We're visiting with licensed professional clinical counselor and certified clinical mental health counselor, Melissa Dahl. She will be presenting Mindful Self-Compassion, the science behind being kind to yourself, this coming Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. And you can find out more at the Fargo-Moorhead West Fargo Chambers website. There are options to attend both in person and virtually. Melissa, this was brought to my attention as self-compassion and its role in the workforce. How does self-compassion impact our professional selves?
Well, we're in a culture where we are designed to be highly competitive. And so we are naturally designed Well, we're naturally designed to be connected to one another. But when we start in elementary school and grade school, we begin competition for grades and for peers. Mm-hmm. And we begin to look towards each other for comparison. And that really doesn't ever go away. And so we enter the workforce and we have comparison models. And that comparison model really enforces and reinforces self-criticism. Self-criticism is really hard on the body because it releases cortisol in our own body.
And that's a stress hormone?
So cortisol is a stress hormone, and it's released when we experience psychological stress. So whether my coworker criticizes my work or whether I criticize my work, my body is going to release cortisol. The opposite of self-criticism is self-compassion. So if I offer myself a more kind way of relating to my work or even relating to my peers at work, I'm now going to lessen that cortisol release and my body is going to enter a more calm state at work. And I'm not going to be so reactive. I'm not going to be so judgmental of myself or others. And I'm going to be able to have a more calm experience even within my own work environment. So it's a really important part to our own relationship with ourselves, but it flows into our work relationship with others.
Hmm.
How we treat ourselves does reflect our relationship with others too.
There has been a growing awareness of what's called workplace culture and how the way that your office is set up or encouraged to talk to one another, or even just, you know, where the break room is located and what's in there and that kind of thing, can impact the way that colleagues interact with one another. I'm wondering, what tips do you have for employers that can go to that next level of how do we encourage self-compassion? It's a deeply personal relationship.
Mm-hmm. I would say if there's a possibility to have some mindful spaces in a work environment where you have calm areas where people can either gather to connect or even, I know of some locations that have Mindful Mondays where the group get together on Mondays over lunch and practice mindful meditation. That doesn't mean they have to bring someone in. You can put on a simple podcast or an app on someone's phone and practice mindfulness together, a 5-minute mindfulness meditation.
Hmm.
So mindfulness is actually about doing less. It's not really about doing more. So just having that shared experience with your coworkers in a vulnerable way that's safe and contained, that is a self-compassionate experience, because that's what we're kind of afraid to do, right?
It's
to be vulnerable like that with our coworkers.
That's my next question.
To do that. Right. We're afraid to do that because we don't want to be judged. And so we take it as something that's kind of already created, like an experience, like a guided meditation, and we offer it, and we take that moment and we experience that with our coworkers in a safe way, in a space that's been created, and we just simply offer it and we see if that catches. And all we're doing is giving permission for that to be an option that's open. And that's a culture experience. And that has to really be kind of led by the people who are making those decisions. They need to be showing up and doing that work too, that vulnerable work as well.
Yeah. I mean, you hear stories of people who bond over a shared trauma. Now, of course, we are not saying that we should introduce a trauma in a workforce, of course. But, you know, what is happening in that experience that there could be a much more gentle analog happening on the workplace level of that vulnerability? What's actually happening in our minds and our bodies that can promote that bonding?
Well, in the science behind it is we're entering a more calm state of being in our brain. We're entering into what's called a theta, T-H-E-T-A. We're entering into more of a theta subconscious place, or we can, and it's a calmer place of thinking and being. It's not in what I call busy brain. You know, if we walk into a lounge room and everybody's talking and everybody has their own agenda for how they're going to communicate, that's a lot of energy. That's a lot of talking energy. It's not a lot of calm. But if we're sitting in a space together listening to a, you know, peaceful meditation or a music, or we're having a shared experience at that theta wave level, we're calming our brains and our bodies. We're kind of or just experiencing a more calm moment in time.
Are there times that we are naturally in a theta brainwave state?
Yes, about the first hour after we wake up and the last hour before we go to sleep. And so that would actually be a very good time to practice self-compassion. And that's why we hear a lot of people talk about prayer, right, when they wake up, prayer, meditation, first in the morning or right before bed, because it's a time where the brain is just waking and the body is just gently waking. There's some research behind not grabbing for your phone right away and trying to wake your mind by getting into the phone, but actually maybe calmly entering into prayer or meditation, starting your day or ending your day that way, because the brain is entering a different state of being or thinking, and can it's basically a gift to your brain. You're relaxing your brain and creating neural pathways that are allowing your brain and body to relax, releasing different hormones and creating calm hormones in the body.
So not first thing in the morning or right before bed grabbing that phone, but when we do want to use that technology for good, what are some of Melissa Dahl's favorite apps to use for mindful self-compassion?
I use Headspace a lot. It's kind of all-encompassing. It just offers a lot of variety.
Melissa Dahl is a licensed professional clinical counselor and certified clinical mental health counselor. She will be presenting Mindful Self-Compassion, the science behind being kind to yourself, this Tuesday the 27th at 3:30 p.m. Central. And you can find out more on the Fargo-Moorhead West Fargo Chambers website. And you can find out more about Melissa at themindfulhealing.org. Melissa, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Coming up next on Main Street, an essay from Tom Ezern.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
Poems for the moment. North Dakota poets reacting to this moment we're in.
Masks. Believe me, it is much better to hide. I only wear it to protect you from what I may possess.
Did she wear a mask? I wear one made of dragonfly print. The dragonfly, a protector during wars, a symbol of rebirth, hope, renewal.
And then in the same hour, North Dakota high school students performing poetry from Poetry Out Loud.
Peoples bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature.
This Sunday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. People who work symbiotically with the land, they pay attention to the sky and know the clouds and when they can be dangerous. Especially, as the Plainsfolk essay this week with historian Tom Ezern indicates, when this cloud is no average cloud.
As Henry stepped out of the door, he noticed a peculiar cloud in the west, too light in color to be rain or even dust. He called Rosie to the door to look. Henry and Rosie Ives, homesteaders in northern Kansas, faced a grave challenge coming from the land itself. Grasshoppers, millions, billions of them, soon covered the ground in a seething, fluttering mass, their jaws constantly at work. I'm quoting from the classic memoir of homesteading on the Great Plains, Sod and Stubble, by John Ives. No other state or province of the plains has such a compelling narrative of the settlement experience as this one from Kansas. But the text is like Cather or Rolvag. It transcends state lines, speaks to the regional experience of the prairies. We love to tell the stories of grasshopper clouds and deadly blizzards and prairie fires and steam engine explosions, and Sod and Stubble gives full voice to distress. It even touches on tragedies seldom told, such as how a community came together to end the suffering of a person in the torturous and dangerous stages of hydrophobia. A disturbing chapter. It is possible that the author, John Ives, Little Joe in his own narrative, had a bitter view of events on the farm in Osborne County on account of his own suffering as a polio victim. On the other hand, because he was disabled, he stayed around the house, and thus gives us an illuminating portrait of a resilient woman, his mother, Rosie. We grieve for Rosie at the close of the book when Henry has died. None of the children are prepared to carry on with the farm, and the widow sits bereft as her possessions are auctioned off. Let me ease your mind about that. In the first place, the children were off leading successful lives. That's the reason for the title, Sod and Stubble. The crop, the children, has been taken off successfully. Further, many years ago, in a bar in Houston, I got to talking with a broken-down old guy, and somehow this book came up in conversation. He told me a fascinating story. It turns out that on leaving the farm, Rosie went off to Lawrence to see John through college. There, she opened a rooming and boarding house for college boys. This guy roomed with Rosie when he went to college. Rosie Ives absolutely loved her life in Lawrence after leaving the farm. It's a point of pride to me that one of my old students, Vaughn Rothenberger, an Osborne County boy himself, discovered the lost manuscript of the 1936 book, Sod and Stubble. He then published, with a scholarly press, a new edition of the work, including some lost chapters. When I was going to college, the scholars told us that homesteading was pretty much a failure and a fraud, a bad idea in the first place. Plains folk, nevertheless, continued to take pride in the settlement experience and to exhibit their homestead certificates, if they had them. Now it seems the scholars are coming around. A team headed by Richard Edwards at the University of Nebraska has launched a massive historical investigation of homesteading, its first fruit being the book, Homesteading the Plains. The work is a deep dive into patent files and local histories that produces a generally favorable assessment of homesteading as an enterprise. Two states have stunted historical literature as to homesteading. The first is Texas, because that state kept its lands on annexation into the Federal Union. The other is North Dakota, because bonanza farming, the antithesis of homesteading, sucks the oxygen out of the history of the Dakota boom. Exhibit A, Hiram Drockey's fine book, The Day of the Bonanza. We should remember that Drockey wrote a companion work about pioneering family farmers, The Challenge of the Prairie. Old High did not romanticize the experience, but he knew a thing or two about homesteading.
Dr. Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, we get a movie review with Matt Olean and our news discussion with Dave Thompson. But now, it's time for today's news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The House has approved a bill that will change the pension plan for public employees. It would affect people hired after January 1, 2023. Right now, it's a defined benefit plan. The bill would make it a defined contribution plan. The current system has an unfunded liability of $1.4 billion, and the proposal would put money toward the current plan to pay that down. Supporters say people who are on the defined benefit plan would have an option to convert to a defined contribution plan, but that would not have to be mandated. Fargo Democratic Representative Pamela Anderson said having a defined benefit plan is one of the things that attracts people to government jobs.
So now we're going to tell the new employees that, which will be younger ones, obviously, don't expect much in raises, 0 to 2% a year. yeah, we really aren't even going to catch up with inflation. We will. We do pay your health insurance, but we got a really a so-so retirement plan.
But supporters of the change say not many employers have a defined benefit plan. Bismarck Republican Representative George Kaiser.
I have yet to find a business other than the health care facilities for physicians that have a defined benefit program left today. They simply can't afford it.
The bill passed 76-16. It will now be worked out in conference committee. The 2021 North Dakota legislative session will last into next week. Legislative leaders had hoped to be adjourned by today, but Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson says there are still agreements to be reached on a number of large budget bills.
But there are a lot of budget bills that we are just so close to getting solved and moving forward in an agreement. So I'm just hoping that next week we can move quickly and be done by Tuesday night or Wednesday. I can't give you a firm date anymore because I expected these bills to be out and on the table 2 days ago, and we're just getting them. So anyway, that kind of holds us up.
The last bill of the session is usually the budget bill for the state's Office of Management and Budget, which also acts as a catch-all bill. Wardner says once you see the OMB conference committee, that will mean adjournment is on the horizon. And a bill to legalize marijuana has now cleared 7 Minnesota House committees. The House Education Finance Committee approved the adult cannabis measure on an 8-6 vote. The committee hearing focused on the bill's safeguards to protect youth. DFL House Majority Leader Ryan Winkler says his goal is educating children on the dangers with marijuana and prohibiting marketing aimed at children.
You can't have gummy bears. You can't have bright colors. You can't have marketing with cartoons and that sort of thing. And no cannabis product is legal in Minnesota unless it is approved by the Cannabis Management Board, which this bill creates.
The bill now goes to the House Public Safety Committee. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, there's the old teletype machine. That means it is time to talk with News Director Dave Thompson for our weekly dive beyond the headlines, getting a little bit more context and analysis for the week's biggest news stories. Dave, thanks as always for joining us.
You are very welcome, Ashley.
Another one of those weeks that we call really newsy.
Oh boy, was it ever newsy, yes.
Yeah, let's start with some veto attempts. Give us a reminder of the bills. There were three one session,
yes,
that the governor vetoed, and two of those have been upheld and one overturned.
Correct. Now, the three bills that he vetoed, one would have allowed the legislature to conduct legislative business during its organizational session. Mm-hmm. He said the Constitution prohibits that, so he vetoed that bill. That was upheld because it didn't get out of the House again. House passed it, Senate passed it, but the House was unable to get the two-thirds vote to override that veto. Now, the second one, that this one was basically overridden, got two-thirds vote in both houses, had to do with prohibiting the governor, the state health officer, or any state official from imposing a mask mandate.
Okay.
So that bill now is gone away, and his power has gone away too. Now, the one that perhaps was the most contentious was the idea about transgender sports. So the bill would require, if you're going to play team sports and you're in high school or grade school, you have to play with a team based on the gender that you were assigned at birth.
Mm-hmm.
It was overturned in the House, but the Senate failed by 4 votes to overturn it.
Okay. Do we know how that compares with the rest of the nation when it comes to that transgender sports? This is a big issue across the country.
Yeah, and it seems to be that the bills that are going across the country right now are all very similar in their nature.
Mm, okay. Three vetoes in one session, and if I recall correctly, he has had one veto in the past. Is that
That's
right?
That's correct, yes. Okay. Yeah, there was a fight over the powers of the budget section.
So I'm just curious, three in one session versus just one in total in the past, does that signify there's some increasing tension in the legislative body, or is it just, you know, happenstance that these are bills that he just didn't agree with?
No, let us be honest with you. They are bills he did not agree with, but there is some tension, especially that was born of the COVID-19 pandemic. That's why you saw the mask bill. That's why you saw other bills to limit the governor's executive powers. Mm-hmm. He did sign one that kind of limited this, his executive powers when it comes to emergencies. Mm-hmm. He didn't like the bill, but he said it was a good compromise about whether or not they'd take away all his power on that. But this was allows the legislature to get involved. Mm. And like Minnesota does, you know, the governor issues an emergency and they have to meet every so often to redefine that emergency. So that's what's going to happen in North Dakota now.
The House has refused the late vaccine passport bill.
That was a long discussion, a very late to the party bill that was – they tried to introduce it. Now, I've got to get a little explanation. I apologize for getting into the weeds here, but there's a thing called a delayed bills committee.
Right.
That's for bills that come in after introduction. But they were not going to call a delays bills committee this close to the end of the session. So what Representative Ertelt did from – he's from Lisbon. He asked the House to approve introduction, but that too takes a two-thirds vote. Mm. And that was a long discussion about prohibiting businesses from issuing, you know, these vaccine passports.
So is the issue more with just when the bill was introduced or more with the bill itself?
Both. It was both at that point. There was the objection about, you know, trying to get it introduced that way at the late hour. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a high bar to get over, two-thirds.
Yeah.
But there was some objection because they worry that prohibiting businesses from requiring vaccine passports is kind of like government intrusion in the business. And that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. There was another bill which basically said the government could not require a business to mandate vaccine passports. Well, that was amended onto another bill, and that bill has failed.
Hmm.
So the issue of vaccine passports for the moment, and until the gavel falls in the session, you can't say never, but for the moment, that is off the table.
And why was the bill introduced so late?
I think it's because of the amendments they put on the first one, basically only dealt with government, but there's a lot of concern among the anti-vax crowd that they don't want businesses, they don't want their places of employment to require that they carry a vaccine passport.
There was a nullification bill defeated in the House, so the nullification bill became nullified?
It did. It became nullified. Yeah, and the nullification bill was basically saying that the state could, by resolution, you know, the state would have the laws that it didn't like that were passed by Congress or executive orders passed by the president. If they didn't like it, they could send it to an interim committee. The interim committee could determine it might be unconstitutional. So we say we're not going to follow it, nullification. Mm-hmm. A very articulate argument to that was from Representative Clemene from Bismarck, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, says this is all null and void because there is the Supremacy Clause. That's not only in the state constitution but also in the North Dakota Constitution, which says laws that are passed at the federal level have supremacy.
How often does something like that come up where the state might want to nullify something that is a federal law?
I think it's more partisan in this than I'm offering my opinion about this. It depends on which party is, you know, in the White House, I think.
Mm.
These things do come up. And most famously, and this was brought up by Senator Ray Holmberg in the Senate, John C. Calhoun, back in the 1860s, leader of the, you know, separatist movement, basically called for a nullification. So there's been some precedent on that. Now, they went much further back in the 1860s and actually seceded from the Union. That's not what this is about. This is about laws that they do not agree with.
There's a new bill that's giving lawmakers more say in the spending of federal money.
Correct. Now, the complaint that you have heard is that you had the state's emergency commission, mm-hmm. which consists of the governor, secretary of state, and the majority leaders of both House and Senate, and the appropriations committee chairs of both House and Senate. They would make a decision. Then they take it to the budget section, which is a subset of the legislature. The budget section had no authority to amend it. It could only say yes or no. So now this new bill has a couple of prongs to it. One, if you take to the budget section can amend. Two, the entire legislature could meet virtually, and I guess the new technology is going to allow this now, you wouldn't have to call him back to Bismarck. You could meet virtually and decide yes or no on some of these spending things, especially when it comes to things like COVID-19 relief money.
Yeah. I saw that there is a special summer session possible. Would that maybe be something over Zoom, or would that be probably in person?
Well, no. They're going to try to get that in person because they're going to be dealing with a lot of issues, but that's still up in the air yet. And that's based on when the state gets the new guidelines on how the new American Rescue money is going to be spent.
Yeah, because the state's getting a little more than $1 billion, but yes, they don't know how they can and cannot spend it.
Right, and I did find out today in talking with Majority Leader Wardner in the Senate that it looks like half might be coming this year, half might be coming next year.
Okay.
So it could be $500 million this year, $500 million next year. Those are pretty big chunks of change.
Income tax reduction plan. This is passed by the House.
Mm-hmm. It's passed by the House. It's still pending and might be in a conference committee by now. But I know that there is a real move by a certain group in the House to come up with some kind of tax reduction. Well, they've tried property tax reduction, but the state does not levy property taxes. And they tried this before, and it didn't seem to work. And they don't want to reduce sales taxes because sales tax is the real big driver of income outside of oil taxes in North Dakota. So there's a plan that if certain key benchmarks are met in terms of things like the budget stabilization fund, the K-12 stabilization fund, and ending fund balance, well, then they can reduce income taxes for the rest of us.
For up to about $150 million?
That is correct, yes.
Okay. There is a bonding bill, speaking of hundreds of millions, this one's $680 million.
Right.
And this looks like a lot of infrastructure specific to flood work?
A lot of it's to flood work, but it's really interesting because of that $680 million bond bill, which the governor has now signed into law,
mm-hmm.
The good chunk of it, $435 million, is going toward finishing the state share of the FM diversion project. Now, this will move fast because this is fast-tracked, and it could mean that construction could start on the FM diversion by October of this year. Of course, there's money also for the continuing appropriations for the Mouse River Flood Project in Minot. And another interesting project in this is Harris Hall at NDSU. And I don't know how familiar you are with NDSU, but it's an agriculture building. What they want to do is, you know, repair it, make it new, and also move the Northern Crops Institute over there and be the real agriculture showcase for North Dakota.
We have just over a minute left. The demand for the COVID-19 vaccine in North Dakota is declining. So we've given out 500,000 doses
mm-hmm.
in a state that has 750, 80-some people.
Right, and of course, 500,000 doses sounds a lot, but a lot of these are two-dose,
right.
too, so...
Okay.
You know, like I got my two-dose vaccine, and I got my second dose this week, so I'm very pleased about that.
Okay, so the 500,000 doesn't mean those people have completed both. That's,
no,
okay, makes
no,
sense.
No.
All right, and is there anything new on that, just that it's going down?
Well, if you notice that a lot of clinics now are going to start welcoming walk-ins. You can walk in and say, I need the vaccine. Normally, you'd have to make an appointment, but now they're going to offer walk-ins.
All right. We check in with News Director Dave Thompson once a week. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra's 95th season finale will take place on Saturday, April 24th at 7:30 p.m. in Ann Nicole Nelson Hall at Minot State University. The grand finale will feature works by Grieg, Bartok, and Mozart. Tickets for the in-person performance or the live stream are available now at MinotSymphony.com or by phone at 701-858-4228. The Minot Symphony Grand Finale, April 24th.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
All right. right, cue the fanfare. That means it is time for another movie review from our movie critic, Matt Olien. And Matt, this is one of those films where it doesn't really matter what any critic might say. People are going to go see it, right?
I call it critic-proof. That's a critic-proof movie. And this is now becoming kind of a franchise.
Godzilla versus Kong. Okay.
And we go back to the Godzilla reboot, I think, 6 years ago. Then we had Skull Island with Brie Larson. I think that was 3 years ago. And so those all kind of feed into this, which is now Godzilla versus Kong. The title says everything you need to know. They're going to fight. They're going to throw down. They're going to get after it in this movie. So it's basically an old-time monster movie from the 50s where Godzilla unprovoked, seemingly, attacks this building in Florida, which is actually a company that is up to nefarious activities. Demian Bichir, a fine Mexican actor, plays kind of the head of this corporation that, yeah, they seem like they're good, but they're really up to no good. As is often the case in these monster movies, somebody's up to no good, and it's provoked Godzilla.
Yeah.
So, of course, the scientists are called in, as they always are in these movies, and they have to kind of do battle with the Army and the Navy. You know, we want to see if we can figure out what's going on, and then they bring Kong into it, and, you know, it's just crazy. But, you know, for right now, as we hopefully near the end of this pandemic, this is exactly what the box office needed. This film, we might look back, Ashley, and say this movie saved theaters because it grossed $40 million its first weekend, which is crazy considering, you know, they're still spacing people out of the theaters. When I go, you have to wear the mask, and it was crowded when I went, but it wasn't a typical Friday night opening pre-pandemic where you couldn't get a seat to a movie like this. So taken on its own terms, it's fine. It's CGI heavy. There's some good actors. Rebecca Hall, Alexander Skarsgård, Millie Bobby Brown plays the daughter of a scientist, and she is kind of a stowaway situation. There's a journey to the Earth's core. There's all kinds of stuff going on scientifically that make absolutely no sense, but that's okay because we're dealing with a giant lizard and a giant ape as well. So, but this is escapism fantasy movie. For what it is, it's fine. I would not say it's a great monster movie, but I think for 2021, this is exactly what theaters needed. It's exactly what the box office needed. Mm-hmm. Go to a mindless monster movie where CGI monsters are fighting each other and scientists are trying to figure out how to save the world, how to save cities, how to get Godzilla to stand down, how to get Kong and Godzilla to kind of fight each other and then maybe get along later. There's all kinds of little things going on. And there's always evildoers run amok, too. Demian Bichir, as I mentioned, is the head of this massive corporation that is up to no good and might have something to do with what's going on. So if you just want some mindless entertainment, this is the movie to go see.
Well, that mindless entertainment, you know, movies in this vein, they tend to be more thought of, at least after the fact, as known for their technical achievements. Mm-hmm. Does this film kind of push the boundaries of our technical achievements?
Yeah, I would say the CGI is good. You know, I can tell what's going on because I know how these movies are made, mm-hmm. and I know exactly how they're edited together, and, you know, things are done in post-production. So I still like the old-time King Kong from the 30s. Ray Harryhausen was a genius. He did Jason and the Argonauts and things like that, and it's kind of that stop-motion animation monster stuff that looked so good on the screen. And, you know, for me, nothing will ever quite top that. You know, skeletons coming out of the ground and Jason and the Argonauts and sword fighting to stop motion animation. So the CGI is what it is. It's cost effective. It's the way to do movies like this. You know, some of the actors are good. I really like Rebecca Hall. She's one of the scientists who knows a few things. But really the scene-stealing performance is Kaylee Hoddle as Gia. And she is this little girl who does not speak, but she sort of communicates with Kong. It's kind of this, you know, just like with the original King Kong, you know, Fay Wray was able to calm the beast down. Mm-hmm. And this little girl can kind of talk to Kong in sign language. Those scenes are actually pretty good. She's able to communicate with Kong, find out what he's thinking, find out what he wants to do. And she's really the linchpin in the whole movie.
Okay. In the last iteration of Godzilla versus Kong, there is what some would say a clear winner. Mm-hmm. Do we get that in this one? Are you going
to
say?
I can't say. Okay. You have to go see it.
Let me just say
there is a third party that joins the battle. A third.
Is it Wonder Woman?
No. This is you'll have to go see what I'm talking about.
Of course, she wouldn't be a monster.
There's quite a melee at the end. Let me just say that. All heck breaks loose.
All right. Well, this film did get an Oscar. You know, it's not getting Best Picture, that kind of things. Back in the 1930s, this first version of it did get a technical achievement award. Who got that and why?
So you want the name of the person?
Yeah.
Is it Marion C. Cooper? He directed it. He directed King Kong. Oh, Ernest Shodzak. Is that his name?
Fred Jackman,
that's right.
And Sidney Saunders.
Okay.
That's who got it for their development and effective use of the translucent cellulose screen in composite photography.
Okay.
Really rolls off
for
the tongue.
For King Kong, 1933, right?
All right. Yep. Well, and speaking of Oscars, we do have the first Oscars in a pandemic world. The last one, you know, narrowly escaped. And now, what are your predictions for this Oscar season?
What a strange year. A lot of these films never appeared in a theater. It's very strange. You know, Trial of the Chicago 7, things like this, just they were not in theaters because the rules were bent for this year. So I think it'd be dumb to pick against Nomadland for Best Picture. It's won all the awards leading up to it. Chloe Zhao is probably going to win Best Director for Nomadland. I think when you get to the acting categories, Ashley, the supporting awards are easier to predict. Daniel Kaluuya has emerged as the front runner for supporting actor in Judas and the Black Messiah as Fred Hampton. So I believe he'll win. And in the Best Supporting Actress category, it now appears that Minari, South Korean actress Yoon Jung-yoon, has emerged as the favorite. She's won a lot of critics' awards. She won the BAFTA. And I do think she's going to win for the wonderful movie Minari. Now, where things get tricky, our lead actor, lead actress. No one has been able to break away from the pack in the Best Actress category as kind of the clear front runner, the way Renee Zellweger did last year for Judy. It was thought for a long time that Carrie Mulligan, it was her award to lose for Promising Young Woman. I think she should win. I think she will eke out a very, very close vote and win. The problem is Viola Davis won the SAG for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and she's great in it. And Frances McDormand won the BAFTA for Nomadland.
Mm-hmm. And she's already got two.
And she's got two, and Viola Davis has one. So the theory here, this is my theory, is Viola Davis and Andra Day in The United States versus Billie Holiday are both in kind of music biopics. And so that might split that vote a little bit. McDormand has two Oscars. And so I think Mulligan will win almost by default because it's a very showy performance. It's an interesting performance. It's a very good film. And keep in mind, there's a high volume of Academy voters that are British. And so that could help Carey Mulligan out as well. Best Actor, I'm starting to think this is going to be closer than I thought it was going to be. So Chadwick Boseman has passed away. Mm-hmm. And certainly he's great in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but there's also a sentimental factor there to award him a posthumous Oscar. It's happened twice before, Heath Ledger and Peter Finch. But Anthony Hopkins just got the BAFTA. And again, there's a high degree of Academy voters that are British, and Hopkins is very well respected. I've seen all five Best Actor performances. I would vote for Anthony Hopkins. I think if Chadwick Boseman was alive, and I wish he was, Hopkins would win. But I think that the sentiment is toward Boseman to win this award. So I think it's going to be a very close award, but do not be surprised if Hopkins wins his second Best Actor Oscar because he's that good in The Father. It is a must-see performance that will break your heart. But if Boseman wins, that's fine as well.
All right. Well, we will tune in this Sunday to see how those predictions bear out. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Now, my first trip to South Africa, my contact there said he would like to have dinner with me so that he could discuss a scheme that he thought would benefit him and me mutually.
So he didn't say it with an evil laugh or anything like that.
Rubbing like that. His hands together.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
You can put your boots in the oven, but that don't make them biscuits.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 23rd. In 1998, an Anne Frank exhibit was shown at the Civic Center in Bismarck. Anne Frank was the German-Dutch teenager who was known through the diary she kept while hiding from the Nazis. Her family was eventually discovered, and Anne Frank died in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Several items from the North Dakota Heritage Center were shown along with the exhibit, including Nazi paraphernalia donated to the Historical Society by veterans of World War II. One of these items was a very rare Nazi Party uniform for an Ortsgruppenleiter, a local group leader of the Nazi Party. The uniform of light brown wool featured blue piping on the jacket, hat, and armband. The uniform had been donated by Axel Nelson, who was born on this date in 1918 near Timmer, North Dakota. This is the story of how he acquired that uniform. Nelson was a staff sergeant traveling with the 86th Infantry Division, also known as the Blackhawk Division. It was spring of 1945, near the end of the war in Europe. Most Germans knew the war was ending. Soldiers were surrendering, and Nazi Party members were removing their uniforms and melting into the civilian population. Nelson was driving his Jeep through a town in southern Germany when he came across a Nazi leader still in full uniform, showing contempt for the passing American soldiers. Nelson pulled his Jeep over and demanded the man remove his uniform. "Nein," replied the Nazi. Nelson leveled his carbine at the man's head and repeated the request. This time, the man complied, and Axel threw the uniform in his Jeep, leaving the Nazi standing in his underwear, no longer looking so arrogant. V.E. Day found Axel in Salzburg, Austria. From there, he was sent to the Pacific for the invasion of Japan. He was in transit when the war ended. He spent his remaining service in the Philippines and mustered out on Christmas Day, 1945. After the war, Nelson donated the items he had acquired to the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Besides the uniform, there were also long red, black, and white swastika banners that had hung from the sides of buildings. Axel Nelson passed away in 2012. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Nelson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, UND philosophy professor Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein joins us for another episode of Philosophical Currents, when we look at current issues through a philosophical lens. This month, we dive into the recent racially charged events in Minneapolis and how watching them from afar changes our experience of them and what they mean to us. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.